and welcome listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk to episode 11. It is Thursday, May 22nd, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And so, Ray, I haven't talked to you all week. How has your week been?
It has been very, very nice, Carolyn. I'm fortunate to have a couple of friends that have very, very nice gardens planted.
And
they have brought to me yellow squash, zucchini, fresh green beans, red potatoes, white potatoes, and their tomatoes are starting to come in now. And I love to cook veggies like that and fix a little cornbread. And, boy, you talk about eating down home. I've enjoyed that this week and a couple of rounds of golf. So I've had a good week. How about you?
Yeah, well, I've had a good week, too, because the weather is nice.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's been kind of hectic as usual with lots of things that I think I need to be doing. But I did, I think I did accomplish quite a bit. You know, gardening really makes me kind of nostalgic about my own gardening. But I know that you really like to cook. You're quite the cook.
Well,
so your friends obviously know that. And I wish I had some friends bringing me a fresh garden stuff.
I'm very fortunate there. Yeah, I'm really fortunate.
Yeah. Well, so our reading tonight covers the period from October 24th, 1941 in the evening to sometime on October 30th. I'm not sure how far we will get, but I think we'll get to that. What is your general impression of these pages, Ray?
Well, there's some very powerful statements here about religion and the institution of the church. It was very introspective for me. I thought it was fabulous. The more I read of this book, I guess it's kind of a vindication of sorts, and I'm proud to see a lot of the things that are written here.
Well, yeah, and another part of it that was a, you know, we were saying last week that there's more in here about Christianity than more than I ever dreamed. It was what I had been familiar with was quite a number of different quotations, but not all of this. So we just keep coming up with it. And the second reading is Himmler and Heydrich were guests, and he's saying some things that are very interesting about what they were going to do with the Jews or what they thought they should do with the Jews. And we'll get to that pretty soon. So, well, I'll start out with this timeline that I didn't mention last week. And once again, listeners, we're on a 90-minute schedule here. So if we go over, the 1 hour, we can do that. And we did it last week. We might do it this week. We try not to go too much over, but to make this a lot longer show. But anyway, that's a possibility. So on the 22nd, 2 days before we're starting in the conversation, a bomb went off in the Romanian headquarters. And it was known to be planted by the Soviets. It was a delayed bomb that was left behind by the Soviets because Odessa was just captured short time before. So they leave behind these hidden bombs and things with delayed mechanisms on them. So this bomb went off, and it killed the Romanian commander, General Glogojanu, and plus 16 other Romanian officers. Just think, killed 16. 17 officers, and there were 4 German naval officers there who were killed. And there had to be a lot of injuries. And so, of course, because of this, some people were shot, and this is what is called the Odessa Massacre. And the story goes that 35,000 Jews were expelled to Slobodka Ghetto. Oh, you know, and that's put across as, oh, such a cruel thing, terrible. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, why were these Jews sent to ghettos? Because they were terrorists. You know, couldn't be trusted in the general population. And then they say that the Odessa Massacre began and continued for 2 days, and they were leading Jews here and there to shoot them and so on. I'm not going to go into that, but the Odessa Massacre is a name given not only to those few days there in Odessa, but also to the entire, all the deaths that took place in the autumn of 1941 and the winter of 1942 in Transnistria, it said. And anyway, these reprisals were carried out under the orders of two Romanian officers. I bet they are angry. Nicholas Delanu and C.D. Nicolescu. And although these events are not doubted by historians, they say, the accounts differ sometimes greatly. I read a little bit about that. And, you know, in the numbers, see, they're always exaggerating the numbers into something huge. That's why I'm not even giving the numbers that are generally listed for this. Well, then, to remember, we're in a war here. The October 23rd, there is heavy desert fighting in Libya, and Rommel thwarts Operation Crusader near Tobruk. That was the British 8th Army that Rommel was able to thwart during their Operation Crusader. Then on October 24th, Kharkov, which is in Ukraine, I believe it is, falls to the German Army Group South. That was important. It was Kharkov. Mm-hmm. It's an important mining and industrial center. So, you know, these victories were going on, and that one was just on the 24th, the day when we're going to start here. So, okay, it's up. It's your turn now.
Okay, 24th of October, 1941, in the evening, special guest, Lieutenant General von Rintelen, coming from Rome.
Oh, yeah, I got a little something to say about him.
Okay.
He was a son of a Royal Prussian lieutenant, a descendant of the Prussian hereditary nobility. He served in World War I, and then in World War II, he joined the general staff. And so he was like a professional soldier. And as of October 1st, 1936, he was used as a military attaché in Rome. As it says here, he's coming from Rome. And he was in Rome for quite a long time. He got, after the outbreak of war in 1939, he was given the rank of major general, and he was at the headquarters of the Italian armed forces. And on June 1st, 1941, he was appointed lieutenant general. And in 1942, general of infantry. But I read somewhere, and then I didn't find it again, but that some thought in the German hierarchy or whatever, thought he had become too attached to Italy. And that, you know, they don't want that. You know, I mean, if you're, there he was in Italy for a long time, but as a German, and if you get to where you like the country you're in, you can get more sympathetic to their interests than to your own.
Sure.
And I guess they thought that might be happening. And so maybe that's why he was there. Maybe he was there for Hitler to talk to him, see what he thought.
It could be.
Yeah, I just brought that up. So anyway.
Now, these are notes that, you know, that were taken down quoting Hitler. So let's begin here. On the whole earth, there's no being, no substance, and probably no human institution that doesn't end by growing old. But it's in the logic of things that every human institution should be convinced of its everlastingness, unless it already carries the seed of its downfall. The hardest steel grows weary. Just as it is certain that one day the earth will disappear, so it is certain that the works of men will be overthrown. All of these manifestations are cyclical. Religion is in perpetual conflict with the spirit of free research. The church's opposition to science was sometimes so violent that it struck off sparks. The church, with a clear awareness of her interests, has made a strategic retreat, with the result that science has lost some of its aggressiveness. The present system of teaching in schools permits the following absurdity. At 10 a.m., the pupils attend a lesson in the catechism, at which the creation of the world is presented to them in accordance with the teachings of the Bible. And at 11 a.m., they attend a lesson in natural science, at which they are taught the theory of evolution. Yet the two doctrines are in complete contradiction. As a child, I suffered from this contradiction and ran my head against a wall. Often I complained to one or another of my teachers against what I had been taught an hour before, and I remember that I drove them to despair. The Christian religion tries to get out of it by explaining that one must attach a symbolic value to the images of Holy Writ. Any man who made the same claim 400 years ago would have ended his career at the stake with an accompaniment of hosannas. By joining in the game of tolerance, religion has won back ground by comparison with bygone centuries. Religion draws all the profit that can be drawn from the fact that science postulates the search for, and not the certain knowledge of, the truth. Let's compare science to a ladder. On every rung, one beholds a wider landscape. But science does not claim to know the essence of things. When science finds that it has to revise one or another notion that it had believed to be definitive, at once religion gloats and declares, "We told you so." To say that is to forget that it's in the nature of science to behave itself thus. For if it decided to assume a dogmatic air, then it would itself become a church.
I thought that was very good, very well phrased.
Yes, I did too. When one says that God provokes the lightning, that's true in a sense, but what is certain is that God does not direct the thunderbolt, as the church claims. The church's explanation of natural phenomena is an abuse, for the church has ulterior interests. True piety is the characteristic of the being who is aware of his weakness and ignorance. Whoever sees God only in an oak tree or in a tabernacle instead of seeing him everywhere is not truly pious. He remains attached to appearances, and when the sky thunders and the lightning strikes, he trembles from fear of being struck as a punishment for the sin he's just committed. A reading of the polemical writings of the 17th and 18th centuries, or of the conversations between Frederick II and Voltaire, inspires one with shame at how our intellectual level, especially of our low intellectual level, especially amongst the military. From now on,
he brings that up every so often. Mm-hmm. He really wants to see cultured people in his military. It offends him when these. He knows that it's a reality, but. He doesn't like it when he sees military officers, particularly if they're of higher ranks, being culturally boorish or ignorant or that. And I just think that this tells us that he wanted all Germans to be the best. You know, he was hoping to lift all Germany up into a, you know, higher strata.
Right, and he also considers it a regression from the way people thought back in the day of Voltaire
and that's very good. That's going to be very good.
From now on, one may consider that there is no gap between the organic and the inorganic worlds. Recent experiments make it possible for one to wonder what distinguishes live bodies from inanimate matter. In the face of this discovery, the church will begin by rising in revolt. Then it will continue to teach its truths. One day, finally, under the battering ram of science, dogma will collapse. It is logical that it should be so, for the human spirit cannot remorselessly apply itself to raising the veil of mystery without people's one day drawing the conclusions. The Ten Commandments are a code of living to which there is no refutation. These precepts correspond to irrefragable needs of the human soul. They're inspired by the best religious spirit, and the churches here support themselves on a solid foundation. The churches are born of the need to give a structure to the religious spirit. Only the forms in which the religious instinct expresses itself can vary. So-and-so doesn't become aware of human littleness unless he is seized by the scruff of the neck. But so-and-so does not need even an unchaining of the elements to teach him the same thing. In the depths of his heart, each man is aware of his puniness. The microscope has taught us that we are hemmed in not only by the infinitely great, but also by the infinitely small, macrocosm and microcosm. To such large considerations are added particular things that are brought to our attention by natural observation, that certain hygienic practices are good for a man. Fasting, for example. It's by no means a result of chance that amongst the ancient Egyptians, no distinction was drawn between medicine and religion. If modern science were to ignore such data, it would be doing harm. On the other hand, superstitions must not be allowed to hamper human progress. That would be so intolerable as to justify the disappearance of religions.
See, there he is again with that hampering progress. He really believes in progress.
Sure.
He's not one of those people who say, oh, we need to go back into the past and live like that or do this or that. He's all for progress, but, in the right way.
Right, and he doesn't want it bogged down by something that he sees as stumbling blocks.
Well, that's why he says, that we should just get, if religion would do that, it would justify getting rid of it altogether, if it would hamper human progress.
Right.
So that's pretty strong.
When a man grows old, his tissues lose their elasticity. The normal man feels a revulsion at the sight of death. This to such a point that it is usually regarded as a sign of bad taste to speak of it lightly. A man who asks if you have made your will is lacking in tact. The younger one is, the less one cares about such matters. But old people cling madly to life. So it's amongst them that the church recruits her best customers. Now, an aside right there to me, I thought that was a fabulous use of the word customers, because what does a customer do? He buys or refuses to buy what you're selling. And for him to use that word, I thought was very, very pertinent. She entices them with the prospect that death interrupts nothing, that beyond our human term, everything continues in much more agreeable conditions. And you'd refuse to leave your little pile of savings to the church? Grosso modo, that's more or less how it goes. That grosso modo, I thought was Latin. It says Italian, meaning roughly. That's more or less how it goes. Is there a single religion that can exist without a dogma? No, for in that case, it would belong to the order of science. Science cannot explain why natural objects are what they are. And that's where religion comes in with its comforting certainties. When incarnated in the churches, religion always finds itself in opposition to life. So the churches would be heading for disaster, and they know it if they didn't cling to a rigid truth. What is contrary to the visible truth must change or disappear. That's the law of life. We have this advantage over our ancestors of 1,000 years ago that we can see the past in depth, which they couldn't. We have this other advantage that we can see it in breadth, an ability that likewise escaped them. For a world population of 2,250 millions, one can count on the earth 170 religions of a certain importance. Each of them claiming, of course, to be the repository of the truth. Now, at least 169 of them, therefore, are mistaken. Amongst the religions practiced today, there is none that goes back further than 2,500 years. But there have been human beings in the baboon category for at least 300,000 years. There's less distance between the man-ape and the ordinary modern man than there is between the ordinary modern man and a man like Schopenhauer. In comparison with this millenary past, what does a period of 2,000 years signify? The universe in its material elements has the same composition, whether we're speaking of the Earth, the Sun, or any other planet. It's impossible to suppose nowadays that organic life exists only on our planet. Does the knowledge brought by science make men happy? That I don't know. But I observe that man can be happy by deluding himself with false knowledge. I grant one must cultivate tolerance. It's senseless to encourage man in the idea that he's a king of creation, as the scientists of the past century tried to make him believe. That same man who, in order to get about quicker, has to straddle a horse, that mammiferous, brainless being. Now, I don't know a more ridiculous claim. The Russians were entitled to attack their priests, but they had no right to assail the idea of a supreme force. It's a fact that we're feeble creatures and that a creative force exists. To seek to deny it is folly. In that case, it's better to believe something false than not to believe anything at all. Who's that little Bolshevik professor who claims to triumph over creation? People like that, we'll break them. Whether we rely on the catechism or on philosophy, we have possibilities in reserve, whilst they, with their purely materialistic conceptions, can only devour one another. And that wraps up that little one. But that last paragraph there, Carolyn, where it says the Russians were entitled to attack their priests, but they had no right to assail the idea of a supreme force. That was the Bolshevik Revolution and the anti-church activity directed by the Jews. At least that's how I interpret it.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, me too.
Saying that, you
sure.
know. You know, by him saying that they're entitled to attack their priests, what he's telling us is that these priests deserved to be attacked for the way they had manipulated and used the people and taken advantage of them.
Well, I think, you know, that the priests weren't all that bad, mm-hmm. and that what he, I just take it that that since the Russian people are entitled, like any people, are entitled to go after their religious class, I guess, if the church class, if they don't like it. But they don't have a right to assail the whole idea of a supreme being.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I took it. And this, again, throughout this whole section here, he is to me, emphasizing his belief in this supreme being. But I was wondering who you think this little Bolshevik professor who claims to triumph over creation is. I couldn't come up with that, really. I don't have any, I don't know what he might mean there, but he's talking about somebody,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, let's see.
Well, I thought of Marx, but I'm not sure that
that's a very good supposition there.
But I don't know if Marx talks about triumphing over creation. I don't know.
I thought about Trotsky.
I don't think he was a professor, was he?
Right. You know, he was a loudmouth speaker and what have you. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, kind of, you know, the rabble.
And he wasn't little. I mean, he was kind of a big shot. So I don't know who this little person would be. But I'd like to go back to up a little ways to where he said that the church entices the people with the prospect that death interrupts nothing. That beyond our human term, everything continues. And I thought, gee, does that mean that Hitler did not believe in consciousness after death? Or is he just saying this in some way that this is what the church says? But I found that kind of interesting because I'm looking for clues here of what his real beliefs were. We know he was a believer in a greater power and so on. But I wonder if he thought that death was basically the end and there was nothing continuing after that.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Well, I kind of think that he felt like, you know, there is possibly a hereafter wherein which reincarnation might prevail.
Well, one time, yeah. Previously, we've read that he mentioned reincarnation.
Mm-hmm. And back to where he says in this particular section about as a child suffering from the contradictions that were taught in his school. In one class, catechism talked to biblical creation. The next one taught science, evolution, and so he said, you know, he drove some of his teachers to despair by asking his questions and about how the two can conflict and the things that had planted into his mind. And when he mentions this, the Christian religion tries to get out of it by explaining that one must attach a symbolic value to the image of the Holy Writ, saying that doing that 400 years ago would have got you burnt at the stake.
Yeah, that was good.
And what, to me, a lot of what he's saying right there is that attitude of the church demanding that you take it on faith.
Well, yeah, but he's also saying there that the church wasn't getting anywhere with that. They were losing their followers, and so they started practicing mm-hmm. more tolerance.
Yes.
And so now they've gone all the way to saying that, well, some of this stuff is symbolic. It's not actual.
Yeah.
Factual.
Yeah. And you know, saying that take it on faith. I think that Hitler's thoughts may have been such that, like, well, natural man's inner spirit doubts that approach of accepting things on faith, you know, because of reason and logic that dominated Hitler's thinking. And, you know, and he to me, that was kind of his attitude when the church is saying, you know, put it this way. What he's told us is, you know, the church as an institution looks out for what's right for that institution and whatever it takes to maintain the level of power that they hold is what they're going to do.
Well, sure. And if you believe that your institution, even if it's a political or religious, is important to the well-being of humanity, and they do believe that, then you have to look out after your institution that mm-hmm. that justifies everything you do along those lines, doesn't it? And this is the way everything is, really. I mean, everything is looking out for its own. It's just a kind of a truism that every organization or whatever that ever gets started finally is its main objective is just to keep itself functioning as an organization.
Sure, just to perpetuate itself.
Yeah, perpetuate, mm-hmm. right.
Sure.
Well, another thing here at the end, you know, when he says, he talks about in this a lot that we're feeble creatures and we don't really have any individual power whatsoever. And that proves that there's that a creative force exists. And then he says it's better to believe something false and not believe anything at all. So mm-hmm. there is, you know, he's definitely not an atheist. And anybody who would ever think to call him that is not understanding it at all. He's always a believer. I think he feels like you have to believe in something. He certainly believed in things very strongly.
That's an excellent observation, and it's a wonderful point to make to these people who call him the devil incarnate, the atheist, and things like this.
Yeah, well, no, and he didn't. That's one of the things he held against Bolshevism so much. Mm-hmm. Their atheism, or he said they were atheists. You know, he's absolutely opposed to atheism and not believing that there's something greater than man and higher than man, and we have to have respect and humility before this.
Mm-hmm. And that line there that we talked about a while ago, the Russians were entitled to attack their priests, but they had no right to assail the idea of supreme force.
Right.
The attacking of the priests would be for either or both sins of omission or commission regarding their flock. They had no right to assail that idea of a supreme force, and that's exactly what the Bolsheviks tried to eliminate.
Right. Okay, well, I think we covered that pretty well.
All righty. Ready to go to 25th
yes,
of October.
Yes, this is a good one.
1941 evening. Special guest, Reich Führer SS Himmler and SS General Obergruppenführer Heydrich. From the rostrum of the Reichstag, I prophesied to Jewry that in the event of wars proving inevitable, the Jew would disappear from Europe.
Now, this speech where he said that, wasn't that, can you determine that exactly? Wasn't that in 1939? Was that the 1939 speech before announcing, right after they invaded Poland, he made that?
Yeah, that's exactly the one I remember because, you know, I watched that video of him giving that speech and then the translating it at the bottom of the video,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, yeah, that's...
He said that. Well, we know he said that, but mm-hmm. I think that might have been when he said it.
Right.
But you know, they got him on that, too. By just saying that, they hang him on that.
Oh, yeah, that because it fits their agenda.
Yeah, but he goes into it more here. Very interesting.
Yes, he does. He says, that race of criminals has on its conscience the 2 million dead of the First World War, and now already hundreds of thousands more. Let nobody tell me that all the same, we can't park them in the marshy parts of Russia. Who's worrying about our troops? It's not a bad idea, by the way, that the public rumors, that public rumor attributes to us a plan to exterminate the Jews. Terror is a salutary thing. The attempt to create a Jewish state will be a failure.
Well, this is kind of a break here. He goes into something else. So let's talk about this right now while it's still fresh. And that right here, he says, let nobody tell me that we can't park them in the marshy parts of Russia. He's right. saying right here that that's the plan.
Yes.
That's the final solution. We're going to move them into Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're going to move them into as far into the middle of Russia as we can. And it's interesting that Himmler and Heydrich are in attendance here, so they must have been saying some things about that, you know. It must have been there for him to be saying these things at the, table.
And then he says, who's worrying about our troops? I mean, it's like everybody's all concerned about
the
Jews.
Yeah.
The Jews. Well, hey, who's worrying about our troops or fighting the battle of their
and
lives?
And who are being, and they're not just fighting, they're being, attacked by
partisans
and the Jews
yeah.
are working for the enemy everywhere, and they're doing terrible things to the troops. So then he says, public rumor attributes to us the plan to exterminate the Jews. So actually, this Wannsee conference was in January 1942, as far as I remember. So it hasn't taken place yet, but there was supposed to be one earlier. And then I think it was the December 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor that set that aside for the time being. So there was all this going on, and he is saying, not knowing what they were going to eventually do
exactly
to the Germans with it, innocently saying it's not a bad idea that this rumor's going around because terror might make them, stop them from doing a lot of things they want to do if they're afraid. That could happen, but you see, who could have known the vile plans of this whole international cabal anyway?
Right.
Who could ever have imagined that they could go as far as they went? Well, he certainly didn't.
Right.
So what he did? Okay. Did you want to say any more about that?
No.
Okay.
The book that contains the reflections of the Emperor Julian should be circulated in millions. What wonderful intelligence, what discernment, all the wisdom of antiquity. It's extraordinary.
Now that's Julian the Apostate again that he talked about last week. And now it makes me, every time I read that, I think I need to go and look him up and read
exactly.
that book and see what he said.
I agree.
He thought it was great, but I forget to do it. Yeah.
With what clairvoyance the authors of the 18th and especially those of the past century criticized Christianity and passed judgment on the evolution of the churches. People only retain from the past what they want to find there. As seen by the Bolshevik, the history of the czars seems like a bloodbath. But what is that compared with the crimes of Bolshevism? There exists a history of the world compiled by Rotek, a liberal of the 40s, in which facts are considered from the point of view of the period. Antiquity is resolutely neglected. We too shall rewrite history from the racial point of view. Starting with isolated examples, we shall proceed to a complete revision. It will be a question not only of studying the sources, but of giving facts a logical link. There are certain facts that can't be satisfactorily explained by the usual methods, so we must take another attitude as our point of departure. As long as students of biology believed in spontaneous generation, it was impossible to explain the presence of microbes. What a certificate of mental poverty it was for Christianity that it destroyed the libraries of the ancient world. Greco-Roman thought was made to seem like the teachings of the devil. And then he uses a quote here, if thou desirest to live, thou shalt not expose thyself unto temptation. Bolshevism sets about its task in the same way as Christianity, so that the faithful may not know what is happening in the rest of the world. The object is to persuade them that the system they enjoy is unique in the world in point of technical and social organization. Somebody told me of a lift man in Moscow, and I'm assuming he means an elevator operator here, who sincerely believed that there were no lifts anywhere else. I never saw anybody so amazed as that Russian ambassador, the engineer, who came to me one evening to thank me for not having put any obstacles in the way of a visit he paid to some German factories. At first, I asked myself if the man was mad. I supposed it was the first time he saw things as they are, and I imagine he sent his government an indiscreet note on that subject. He was recalled to Moscow a few days later, and we learned he'd been shot. Christianity set itself systematically to destroy ancient culture. What came to us was passed down by chance, or else it was a product of Roman liberal writers. Perhaps we are entirely ignorant of humanity's most precious spiritual treasures. Who can know what was there? The papacy was faithful to these tactics even during recorded history. How did people behave during the age of the great explorations toward the spiritual riches of Central America? In our part of the world, the Jews would have immediately eliminated Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Kant. If the Bolsheviks had dominion over us for 200 years, what works of our past would be handed on to posterity? Our great men would fall into oblivion, or else they'd be presented to future generations as criminals and bandits. I don't believe at all in the truth of certain mental pictures that many people have of the Roman emperors. I'm sure that Nero didn't set fire to Rome. It was the Christian Bolsheviks who did that, just as the Commune set fire to Paris in 1871 and the Communists set fire to the Reichstag in 1932. There is a form of hypocrisy, typically Protestant, that is impudence itself. Catholicism has this much good about it, that it ignores the moral strictness of the evangelicals. In Catholic regions, life is more endurable, for the priest himself succumbs more easily to human weaknesses. So he permits his flock not to dramatize sin. How would the church earn her living if not by the sins of the faithful? She declares herself satisfied if one goes to confession. Indulgence, at a tariff, supplies the church with her daily bread. As for the fruits of sin, the soul that fears limbo is a candidate for baptism, that is to say, another customer, and so business goes on. It is a fact that in Catholic parts of the world, there are many more illegitimate births than in Protestant parts.
Well, what do you think about this? Boy, he's really talking about how the church makes money, and they still did at that time, obviously.
Sure.
In selling indulgences.
Yes. And that was one of the things that Martin Luther hammered so much in, when he attempted to reform the church. He was certainly not out to create another religion and, you know, that Lutheranism or whatever. He just wanted to reform the Catholic Church and all the bad stuff that went in it. And I think this remark here about fact that in the Catholic parts of the world there are many more illegitimate births than in Protestant parts lies in the fact that maybe Catholics take more of a view that sex is something that's natural and not a sin, as a lot of Protestant churches have taught.
Well, I think he must be meaning that Catholics can be forgiven for everything, and Protestants can't in the way it developed. So Protestants, what they do and how they live is, you know, really going to be judged on Judgment Day. But for the Catholics, they just go to confession. And they confess, and they're sorry, and they're given a little bit of some prayers to say, and I guess they used to, you know, have to pay some money or something. And then they, I don't know if ordinary people did that, but I guess, well, you know, here's the other thing, is that Luther was way back, and so supposedly the church reformed itself. That was the Catholic Reformation. And they got rid of a lot of that stuff. So I don't really quite understand. Hitler seems to be talking like it's still going on, but I think it wasn't.
Well, he gives a couple of examples here in a little bit about people buying their way out of a marriage. And I think that was current, but we'll find out.
Okay, go ahead.
In Austria, Protestantism was free of all bigotry. It was truly a movement of protest against Catholicism. Moreover, these Protestants were entirely devoted to the German cause. A scandal is that when a believer leaves a particular faith, he is compelled to pay the ecclesiastical tax for another year. A simple statement should be enough to free him at once from owing anything further. We'll put all of that right as soon as we have peace again. Take Goebbels, for example. He married a Protestant. At once, he was put under the church's ban. Very naturally, he declared that he would stop paying the ecclesiastical tax. But the church doesn't see things that way. Exclusion is a punishment which does not remove the obligation to pay the tax. For my part, the church held it against me that I was a witness to this marriage. They would certainly have put me under the ban, too, if they had not calculated that it might have won me new sympathies.
That's pretty interesting because, mm-hmm. you know, he's saying there that he was the best man for Joseph Goebbels
right.
in his, when he got married. Of course, Hitler played a big part in wanting Goebbels and Magda to get married.
Mm-hmm.
He thought they should, and so they did. And they seemed to be happily married for the most part, although, as all marriages are, a lot of stuff was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's something to remember that that was in 1931.
Okay, good. Every marriage concluded as the result of a divorce is regarded by the church as living in sin. The result is that in Austria, for example, nobody cares about the commandments of the church. From this point of view, Austria was in advance of Germany. The most extraordinary divorce story I know is that of Starenberg. The church allowed him to obtain a divorce for a payment of 250,000 shillings. The reason advanced by agreement between the parties was that the marriage was null and void since the contracting parties had come together with the firm intention of not performing their marital duties. Since Starenberg had no money, the sum was paid by the Heimwehr. What hasn't the church discovered as a source of revenue in the course of these 1,500 years? It's an unending circle.
Yeah, and they were still doing this as long as they still had this ban on divorce, which I think is gone now. But where if you wanted to divorce if you were high class people and you wanted to get a divorce, if you paid enough money, they would come up with some phony thing that you never did consummate your marriage, mm-hmm. and you never did this, you never did that, and the officials would approve it. And there you'd go on your way.
Yeah, you know what was dictating that was the dollar sign.
Oh yeah, and then these rich people would continue to support the church because it helped them out and all. So
sure.
It's all, you know, it's all the same kind of thing that goes on.
Right. And he interestingly here he says, I have numerous accounts to settle about which I cannot think today, but that doesn't mean I forget them. I write them down. The time will come to bring out the big book.
That's interesting, isn't it? Maybe he's talking so tough like that because Himmler and Heydrich are there, and they're all the tough guys, you know.
And then, interestingly, here he says, even with regard to the Jews, I found myself remaining inactive. There's no sense in adding uselessly to the difficulties of the moment. One acts more shrewdly when one bides one's time. When I read of the speeches of a man like Galen, I tell myself that there's no point in administering pinpricks, and that for the moment it's preferable to be silent. Why should anyone have room to doubt the durability of our movement? And if I reflect that it will last several centuries, then I can offer myself the luxury of waiting. I would not have reached my final reckoning with Marxism if I hadn't had the strength on my side. Methods of
I think that's the end of him talking about Galen. And, of course, Galen is a bishop that gave him a hard time, was supportive at first, you know, but then certain things were, he was the one with the euthanasia, and he spoke out in the church. He was a Protestant bishop, and he had a lot of following, as church people did then. And so Hitler just stopped that program and didn't say anything. And it probably was smart, because if he would have started a fight with Galen at that time, who knows how that would have looked, you know?
Sure.
So,
you know, one thing I got out of that paragraph there, Carolyn, you know, when he says, even with regards to the Jews, there's no sense in adding uselessly to the difficulties of this moment. Bide your time, whatever. What he's saying here is, I'll deal with these Jews later.
Oh, yeah.
And meaning somewhere down the line when the trying to stay alive with, you know, in the battlefield becomes, you know, when we've taken care of that, then we'll turn our attention to this. And, you know, so there was no, obviously no...
Yeah, and he's also saying, I suppose, Ray, that that he is going to deal with the Jewish question.
Yes.
Even if he's not doing something right now, even if he's not doing what some people would like him to be doing right now, it's not that he's decided not to do anything. He is going to take care of it eventually.
Yeah, but it's put on the back burner.
Yeah, right.
And see all these false historians, these establishment pimps, as I call them, when they come out with that boy, you know, from the get-go, he was out to destroy the poor Jews of the world, execute them, exterminate them, whatever.
Oh, yeah, they couldn't do it fast enough.
Yeah, yeah, and here he's saying, hey, don't worry, I'm aware of this, but we're going to put it on the back burner because there are more important items to take care of now. Methods of persuasion of a moral order are not an effective weapon against those who despise the truth. When we have to do with priests, for example, of a church who know that everything about it is based on lies and who live by it, they think me a spoil sport when I rise up in their midst. Indeed, I am going to spoil their little games. In 1905 to 1906, when the modernist movement broke out, there were such excesses that some priests, in reaction, overran the reformers' objectives and became real revolutionaries. They were at once expelled, of course. The power of the church was so great that they were ruined. Men like the Abbot Schachleiter suffered a lot. Nowadays, a priest who's unfrocked can build a new career for himself. What gave the power of the church such a handle was the fact that the civil power didn't want to interfere in these matters at any price. Things have changed a great deal since then. Nowadays, great numbers of priests are forsaking the church. Obviously, there's a hard core, and I shall never get them all. You don't imagine I can convert the Holy Father. One does not persuade a man who's at the head of such a gigantic concern to give it up. It's his livelihood. I grant, moreover, that having grown up in it, he can't conceive of the possibility of anything else. Yeah, just on that right there, I like the way he uses the definition of the church as, or the Pope as, the head of a giant concern. You know, it's like a big industry or any other business. As for the nuns, I'm opposed to the use of force. They'd be incapable of leading any other life. They'd be without support, literally ruined. In this respect, the Catholic Church has taken over the institution of the Vestal Virgins. As soon as a girl becomes a woman, she's faced with the problem of getting a man. If she doesn't find a fiancé, or if she loses him, it's possible that she may refuse to have anything more to do with life and may prefer to retire to a convent. It can also happen that parents may promise their children to the Church. When a human being has spent 10 years in a monastery or a convent, he or she loses the exact idea of reality. For a woman, a part is played by the sense of belonging to a community that takes care of her. When she lacks the support of a man, she quite naturally looks for this support elsewhere. In Germany, we have, unfortunately, 2 million more women than men. A girl's object is, and should be, to get married. Rather than die as an old maid, it's better for her to have a child without more ado. Nature doesn't care the least bit whether, as a preliminary, the people concerned have paid a visit to the registrar. Nature wants a woman to be fertile. Many women go slightly off their heads when they don't bear children. Everybody says of a childless woman, what a hysterical creature. It's 1,000 times preferable that she should have a natural child, and thus a reason for existence, rather than slowly wither.
Well, you know, of course, this was the attitude in general, but he knew a lot of women and he liked them who weren't hysterical, who didn't have children. But, you know, that's just me saying that. But at the same time, what's really interesting here is that he's saying, as it was kind of with the Lebensborn, although at that I don't want to create any more misunderstanding about that than there was, but bringing children into the world, it's a good thing to do. And he's saying, rather than die as an old maid, let a woman have a child, even if she doesn't have a husband, which happens in the rural parts. and was fairly common in, not common, but, you know, happened in Austria, because that was pretty rural and mountainous and so on. It doesn't matter if you visit the registrar or not. Just go ahead, you know, have children.
Sure, sure. And you know, that the statement that they have 2 million more women than men. And then earlier in our studies when, you know, he said something about there were programs that they would love to have instituted in World War One that they are immediately before or after, but they couldn't do it because of lack of population, lack of power to devote to that.
So right, and that 2 million more women must be the result of World War One.
That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah, it has to be. So it was still a problem at that time, and then there were more men were, well, then even during the, from 39 to 41, more and more men were being killed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, we're gonna use our extra time because I think we need to get further along here. So let's go right ahead with the 26th and 27th. And I've got on the timeline on October 27th, Army Group South forces, I guess not the whole Army Group South, but some of them, reached Sevastopol. But the Northern forces' tanks are slowed or stopped entirely by mud. The leading tanks are on the outskirts of Moscow at this time, too. So that's two different places, Sevastopol in the south and Moscow in the middle part. So we know that there was the assault on Moscow, and the first of the tanks are on the outskirts now. So that's on October 27th.
Okay. 26th, 27th, October 1941, evening. Special guest, Admiral Fricke. National independence, as independence on the political level, depended as much on autarky as on military power. The essential thing for us is not to repeat the mistake of hurling ourselves into foreign markets. The importations of our merchant marine can be limited to 3 or 4 million tons. It's enough for us to receive coffee and tea from the African continent. We have everything else here in Europe. Germany was once one of the great exporters of wool. When Australian wool conquered the markets, our national economy suddenly switched over and began importing. I wish today we had 30 million sheep. Nobody will ever snatch the East from us. We have a quasi-monopoly of potash. We shall soon supply the wheat for all of Europe, the coal, the steel, the wood. To exploit the Ukraine properly, that new Indian empire, I need only peace in the West. The frontier police will be enough to ensure us the quiet conditions necessary for the exploitation of the conquered territories. I attach no importance to a formal juridical end to the war on the Eastern Front. If the English are clever, they'll seize the psychological moment to make an about turn, and they will march on our side. By getting out of the war now, the English would succeed in putting their principal competitor, the United States, out of the game for 30 years. Roosevelt would be shown up as an imposter. The country would be enormously in debt by reason of its manufacture of war materials, which would become pointless, and unemployment would rise to gigantic proportions. For me, the object is to exploit the advantages of continental hegemony. It is ridiculous to think of a world policy as long as one does not control the continent. The Spaniards, the Dutch, the French, and ourselves have learned that by experience. When we are masters of Europe, we have a dominant position in the world. 130 million people in the Reich, 90 in the Ukraine. Add to these the other states of the new Europe, and we'll be 400 millions compared with the 130 million Americans. If the British Empire collapsed today, it would be thanks to our arms. But we'd get no benefit, for we wouldn't be the heirs. Russia would take India. Japan would take Eastern Asia. The United States would take Canada. I couldn't even prevent the Americans from gaining a firm hold in Africa. In the case of England's being sunk, I would have no profit but the obligation to fight her successors. a day might come when I could take a share of this bankruptcy, but on condition of its being postponed. At present, England no longer interests me. I'm interested only in what's behind her. We need have no fears for our own future. I shall leave behind me not only the most powerful army, but also a party that will be the most voracious animal in world history. Wow.
He's talking about 400 millions. He's talking about Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Or is he talking about, oh no, maybe he's talking about the Europe, the United Europe that he's going to lead and Ukraine. Maybe that's what he calls the New Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, because that, no, because he says 130 million plus 90 million doesn't
Ukraine.
Add up to 400 million.
Yeah, that's 220, but then add to these the other states of the new Europe, and we'll be 400 million.
Yeah, right. So I don't know what he's talking about. But anyway, he's got big plans, and he's including all these peoples. And then he talks about Ukraine calls it the new Indian Empire. So he's comparing India for the British Empire mm-hmm. to what mm-hmm. Ukraine will be for his Germanic Europe.
Right, right. For me.
For the new Europe.
Yeah, the economic powerhouse that he wants to make of Europe.
Yeah, and that Ukraine, he just sees so much wealth and riches in Ukraine. And it's interesting because it is that kind of a country, mm-hmm. but it has never been taken advantage of properly. And it's Ukraine, I'm going to say something that's going to upset people probably, but Ukraine is a country that is similar in the sense to Africa. To African countries, where it's got so much wealth, but the people that are the natural inhabitants of there don't have the ability to bring it out, you know, mm-hmm. to make use of it. Well,
sure.
That's my opinion.
No, I agree.
Still have this problem, you know. The Ukrainians are not the greatest mm-hmm. minds and organized people, but he liked the Ukrainians, or he liked their country, but he liked them too, and thought that, you know, there would be something for them there, and they would be far better off than they had been. Well, they've always been taken advantage of by mm-hmm. by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's also interesting to me right here that he talks about the British, and that, you know, they really don't matter to him now because. You know, they don't concern him. He's gone over about Roosevelt building up the United States, trying to get it out of the Great Depression by manufacturing and selling all these arms to England and things like this. And he says, whereas if England woke up and got out of this war, which would have certainly been in its own best interest,
mm-hmm.
That it would have left Roosevelt looking like a damn fool, which he really was. Well, no, he's quite a shrewd fool. But, I like those remarks. And and he says, so what? If England goes under, Germany won't be the beneficiary of that stuff. You know, it doesn't help us to see England go down, is what he was talking about. Now, yeah, he's fighting them in a war. He wants to defeat them, but he prefers that the British get out of that war on their own.
Wake
up and realize that, hey, we're killing ourselves. We're losing our empire by doing this foolish fighting with Germany.
He's always wanted that, and he never stopped wanting that, he knew that Churchill was never going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only, you know, sensible thing in his mind, and I think he means here England no longer interests me because he knows it's not going to change, but I can't really say what he means.
Well, that sentence right there, Carolyn, I'm glad you used that because I was going to ask you your take on the sentence immediately following that when he says, at present, England no longer interests me. I'm interested only in what's behind her. Does he mean England's past history, or does he mean the Jews that are pushing England to stay in this war?
Maybe that's it. I didn't come up with that. That could be.
You know, that was kind of an interesting thing there. I wasn't sure about what take.
Here's where the translators don't make it clear.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it wasn't clear to them,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's not a sentence that's written with very much clarity.
Right, right. And if he's talking about, who is the power behind the throne that's handing Winston Churchill his script? that's doggedly determined to keep England in this war against Germany. You know, is he talking about those people? That would certainly make sense. But,
yes.
You know, it's open to interpretation.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. It is. Well, you know, Ray, I think we'll, I really think we should do the next two. The next one is real short,
okay.
But the other
yeah.
one is long. But I think it's worth going maybe
yeah.
the full 90 minutes to get that far.
Okay.
All right.
All right, let's see what we can do here. 28th of October, 1941, evening. I see no harm in shooting at game. I merely say that it's a dreary sport. The part of shooting I like best is the target. Next to that, the poacher. He at least risks his life at the sport. The feeblest abortion can declare war on a deer. The battle between a repeating rifle and a rabbit, which has made no progress for 3,000 years, is too unequal. If Mr. So-and-so were to outrun the rabbit, I'd take my hat off to him. Unless I'm mistaken, shooting is not a popular sport. If I were a shot, it would do me more harm in the minds of my supporters than a lost battle. I like that. That's wonderful. It's short, but it's, boy, it's wonderful.
Well, yeah. I think you're against that. You're against
yes.
hunting, aren't you?
Yeah. It tells me of his respect for all life.
Well, he says this quite every so often. You know, a lot of these National Socialists were like to go out and hunt and shoot and so on, and he just never did. It never appealed to him at all, and he doesn't like to kill the animals.
Right.
Thinks it's mostly wasteful.
Sure.
And he talks about that also later on, even more.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of jokes about it.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, that's his position. So he has to say something about it every so often.
I like that. You know, when I was a little boy, Carolina, grew up, and my daddy told me way back then, he said, son, you can tell an awful lot about the character of a man by the way he treats those weaker than himself and the way he treats animals. And boy, I've learned in my decades of existence, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Anyway, 29th of October, 1941, in the evening, special guest, Field Marshal von Klug, Reich Minister Dr. Todt, Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler, and Gauleiter Forster. In a campaign, it's the infantryman who, when all is said, sets the tempo of operations with his legs. That consideration should bid us to keep motorization within reasonable limits. Instead of the six horses that used to pull an instrument of war, they've taken to using an infinitely more powerful motor engine, with the sole object of making possible a speed which is in practice unusable. That's been proved. In the choice between mobility and power, the decision in peacetime is given too easily in favor of mobility. At the end of the First World War, experience had shown that only the heaviest and most thickly armored tank had any value. This didn't prevent people, as soon as peace had returned, from setting about constructing ultralight tanks. Within our own frontiers, we have a network of perfect roads, and this encourages us to believe that speed is a decisive factor. I desire one thing, that those of our commanders who have frontline experience should give their opinions on this subject, and that it should be respected. To allow us, even in peacetime, to continue our experiments and keep our army at its highest level of efficiency, it's essential that we should have a gigantic plane for maneuvers, combining all possible wartime conditions. And that's why I've set my heart on the Pripyat Marshes, a region with an area of 500 kilometers by 300.
Yeah, that was in where they
yeah.
were going into Russia. But now, just to remember that this von Kluge is a field marshal who's commanding a big part of the Eastern Front. So he's talking about this stuff, you know, the tanks and so on.
Yeah, and those Pripyat Marshes that he's talking about, that's in southern Belarus and northern Ukraine. And it was interesting to read about the rainfall there and everything that keeps that a marshland and excellent for training. The German army will retain all its value if the peace we conclude on the Eastern Front is not of a formal juridical character. Now, if the Croats, you call them Croats or Croats?
Well, I think it's better to call them Croats, but I think it's okay to call them Croats. Some people mm-hmm. say Croat.
Mm-hmm. were part of the Reich, we'd have them serving as faithful auxiliaries of the German Führer to police our marshes. Whatever happens, one shouldn't treat them as Italy is doing at present. The Croats are a proud people. They should be bound directly to the Führer by an oath of loyalty. Like that, one could rely upon them absolutely. When I have Veternik standing in front of me, I behold the very type of Croat as I've always known him, unshakable in his friendships, a man whose oath is eternally binding. The Croats are very keen on not being regarded as Slavs. According to them, they're descended from the Goths. The fact that they speak a Slav language is only an accident, they say. Here's a thing that's possible only in Germany. My present Minister of Justice is the very man who, in his capacity of Bavarian Minister, had me imprisoned in Landsberg. The former director of that prison has become the head of Bavaria's penitentiary services. At the time, I'd given my men orders not to leave a prison without first having converted the whole prison staff to National Socialism. The wife of the director of Landsberg became a fervent devotee of the movement. Almost all her sons belonged to the Oberland Free Corps. As for the father, who was not entitled to have an opinion, it seemed to him reasonable at the time when he was obliged to rage against me to spend his nights in the prison to shelter from household quarrels. None of the guards was offensive in his attitude towards us. The first time I was condemned for being a threat to public safety, there were four of us, and we'd decided to transform the prison into a National Socialist citadel. We'd arranged things in such a way that every time one of us was set free, someone else came to take his place. In 1923, when Bruckner was imprisoned, the whole prison was National Socialist, including the director's daughters. It's not easy to be successful in life, and for some people, the difficulties are piled on unjustly. When there's a disparity between the work demanded and the capacities of the man for whom the work is demanded, how can he be expected to work with enthusiasm? Every time we went to Bitterfeld, we were eager to do only one thing, to take the road back. How is one to demand of a worker in a spot like that he should devote himself to his work with joy and gusto? For these men, life didn't begin until they put on their brown shirts. That's why we found them such fanatical supporters. Besides, when one discovers talents and people forced to work in such conditions, the best one can do is to get them away from the place. Our duty is to smooth the way before them, despite the formalists who are always obsessed by the idea of parchments. Some trades have less need for theoretical knowledge than for a skilled, sure hand. And if these men are awkward in their manners, what does it matter? It's a fault that's quickly cured. In the party, I've had extraordinary experiences of that sort of thing, even with men who've held the highest jobs. Former farm workers can pass the tests, and yet what a change from their previous life. On the other hand, we find minor jobs for officials who've been through the usual mill and whom one can't get anything out of. The least adaptable are the men who, by temperament, have chosen a trade that calls for no imagination, a trade at which one constantly repeats the same movements. For a teacher, for example, it's necessary to repeat the teaching of the alphabet once a year. If a person like that is called on to do a completely different job, it may lead to the worst mistakes. There's no reason to educate teachers in upper schools, advanced studies, and then to teach peasants' children for 35 years that B-A spells Ba. What a waste. A man who has been shaped by advanced studies couldn't be satisfied with such a modest post, and I've therefore decreed that in the normal schools for teachers, instruction is not to be carried too far. Nevertheless, most gifted pupils will have the possibility of pursuing their studies somewhere else at the state's expense. I'll go a step further. It will be a great problem to find jobs for the re-enlisted sergeants. A great part of them could be made teachers at village schools. It's easier to make a teacher of an old soldier than to make an officer of a teacher. Those old soldiers will also be excellent gymnastics instructors, but it goes without saying that we shall not give up putting teachers through courses. Reenlisted men give the Army the solid structure it needs. It's the weakness of the Italian and Romanian armies that they haven't anything like that. But since one can't oblige these men to spend all their lives in the Army, it's important to create privileged positions for them. For example, we'll put them in charge of service stations, just as in the old Austria, they used to be given tobacconist shops. The secret, in any case, is to give each man a chance to get on in life, even outside his own trade. Ancient China used to be a model for that, as long as the teachings of Confucius still throve there. The poorest young village lad could aspire to become a mandarin. It's all wrong that a man's whole life should depend on a diploma that he either receives or doesn't at the age of 17. I was a victim of that system myself. I wanted to go to the School of Fine Arts. The first question of the examiner to whom I'd submitted my work was, "Which school of arts and crafts do you come from?" He found it difficult to believe me when I replied that I hadn't been to any, for he saw that I had an indisputable talent for architecture. My disappointment was all the greater since my original idea had been to paint. It was confirmed that I had a gift for architecture, and I learnt at the same time that it was impossible for me to enter a specialized school because I hadn't a matriculation certificate. I therefore resigned myself to continuing my efforts as a self-taught man, and I decided to go and settle in Germany. So I arrived, full of enthusiasm, in Munich. I intended to study for another 3 years, and my hope was to join Heilmann and Littmann as a designer. I'd enter for the first competition, and I told myself that then I'd show what I could do. That was why when the shortlisted plans for the new opera house at Berlin were published, and I saw that my own project was less bad than those that had been printed, my heart beat high. I had specialized in that sort of architecture. What I still know about it now is only a pale reflection of what I used to know about it at the time. Von Kluge asked a question. "My Führer, what were your impressions when you visited Paris last year?" I was very happy to think that there was at least one city in the Reich that was superior to Paris from the point of view of taste. I mean, Vienna. The old part of Paris gives a feeling of complete distinction. The great vistas are imposing. Over a period of years, I sent my colleagues to Paris so as to accustom them to grandeur against the time when we would undertake on new bases the remaking and development of Berlin. At present, Berlin doesn't exist, but one day she'll be more beautiful than Paris. With the exception of the Eiffel Tower, Paris has nothing of the sort that gives a city its private character, as the Colosseum does to Rome. It was a relief to me that we weren't obliged to destroy Paris. The greater the calm with which I contemplate the destruction of St. Petersburg and Moscow, the more I'd have suffered at the destruction of Paris. Every finished work is of value as an example. One takes the opportunity of learning, one sees the mistakes, and seeks to do better. The Ring in Vienna would not exist without the Paris boulevards. It's a copy of them. The Dome of the Invalides makes a deep impression. The Pantheon, I found a horrible disappointment. The busts alone can be defended, but those sculptures, what a riot of cancerous tumors. The Madeleine, on the other hand, has a sober grandeur. Keitel intervened. "Remember how embarrassed we were at the opera when you wanted to visit certain rooms?" "Yes, it's queer. The rooms once reserved for the emperor have been transformed into libraries. The Republic fights to protect its presidents from temptations to the spirit of grandeur. I've known the plans for the opera since my youth. Being confronted with the reality made me reflect that the opera houses of Vienna and Dresden were built with more taste. The Paris Opera has an interior decorated in an overloaded style." I paid my visit very early in the morning, between 6 and 9. I wanted to refrain from exciting the population by my presence. The first newspaper seller who recognized me stood there and gaped. I still have before me the mental picture of that woman in Lille who saw me from her window and exclaimed, "The devil!" Finally, we went up to the Sacré-Cœur, appalling, but on the whole, Paris remains one of the jewels of Europe.
Wow, that's nice.
Yeah, and you know, Carolyn, I looked up all of those terms there, the things he talked about, the Madeleine, the Sacré-Cœur. The Madeleine is a Roman Catholic church, and then there's the Dome of the Invalides, the Invalides, Royal Chapel. It was a hospital for invalid soldiers at one time, but the architecture on it is beautiful, and I looked up pictures of each of those places, and they are really, really attractive buildings.
Oh, they're some of the greatest sightseeing things in Paris.
That Sacré-Cœur is a basilica, just very, very beautiful.
Well, the Napoleon is buried in the Invalides. How do you pronounce that?
Invalides.
Invalides. He's buried there, and Hitler and his entourage went there on their 3-hour trip through Paris early in the morning, and this took place right before the signing of the armistice, but it was, you know, after the surrender and all of that, and they were prepared to sign the armistice. And that's another thing, you know, bringing up how that Paris signed an armistice with Germany. I mean, people who understand this know this. Mm-hmm. And so everything that Germany did in Paris after that was perfectly legal and right, and yet they talk like, oh, these Germans came in and, you know, were occupying this, the French people, et cetera, and blah, 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 and the resistance was justified. That resistance was illegal, absolutely, because the French government authorities had signed, military authorities and so on, had signed this agreement that they wouldn't do anything to hinder the Germans. So, you know, the whole thing is just screwed up. But this
It is. Establishment historians just drive me up the wall with that talk about the oppressed French and how they hated the Germans and things like this. And there were many, many thousands of French that were ticked off like hell at the Allies for the damage they did to their country and then invasion, and that actually existed. They knew they existed quite well. They were left alone. They were respected by the Germans. You know, in the German military, they had orders, hey, get along with the population. You know, don't make enemies here. And it's just false all the way around.
It is. Yeah. And that's because the British and the Americans had to do that, and they were supporting the resistance, which was also illegal. The whole thing. They did so many illegal criminal things during the war. But, of course, since they won, they don't have to.
Right. They don't have to answer
responsible for it. Don't. Yeah. I enjoyed this part where he's talking about the Croats. Obviously, the Croats were great allies of Germany and were the only ones who really stuck it through all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. And they certainly suffered for it, too.
Oh, never. Yes.
And I wonder if this is some of Hitler's prejudice against, revealing some prejudice against the Slavs, that he says the Croats are keen on not being regarded as Slavs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's true of Croats in general, or just the ones that were...
I would think it'd be very general.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to some Croats. I'm going to have to read up on that, see if I can find anything about it, because they're considered Slavs, and he says that they speak a Slav language. But he's saying that they say it's an accident that happened. They think they were just descended from the Goths.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That would be interesting if that were true.
Sure.
I know the Germans talked a lot about when they were in Western Russia and in Ukraine, they talked a lot about the people looking like they were descendants from the Goths. And they thought that a lot of them were descendants from the Goths, which they thought was a better bloodline, you know, and so on. I really don't know what the truth of all that is.
Mm-hmm.
But, so what else was in here?
Well, there was one thing that I thought was unique, Carolyn, where he's talking about he had hoped to join Heilmann and Littmann as a designer. And then he says when he entered this this contest when the shortlisted plans for the new opera house at Berlin were published, and I saw that my own project was less bad than those which had been printed. Now, such an interesting choice of words. He could have said, I saw that my own project was better than those that had been printed, but he says mine was less bad than them. And I thought that's kind of unique.
Yeah, it was pretty modest of him, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he always did do excellent architectural work.
Oh, yeah.
And when he talked about how his schooling thing went, that that the reason he couldn't get into the architectural school, and you know, he wanted to get into painting school, and
yes.
at the painting school they told him, no, you should be an architect. Your mm-hmm. talent lies, because all of his paintings were of buildings and things for the most part,
mm-hmm.
and they thought they were very good, and they said, you show your real field is architecture. That's where your talent is. And so he went to, he was okay with that. He said, whoa, wow, you know. So he went to the architectural school, and then they liked what they saw, but then the fact that he had not been to the proper preliminary school.
Yeah, he didn't have that little degree.
Yeah, and he also didn't even finish the gymnasium, the upper high school. You know, he quit before he finished, and that made it impossible for him. So that's why he couldn't get in. It wasn't because he wasn't good enough.
That's right.
And then he said, well, I decided I would study on my own. I'd have to, you know, improve myself on my own. And that's, and he went very seriously to painting, architecture, and the way he supported himself by painting the landmark buildings around in Munich and selling them, you know, to tourists and all kinds of people. But he was trying to get himself prepared to study architecture somehow, somewhere. But then the war came along, and then he went into a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, and you know, he's telling this story, so he knows what happened to him, and he's, as far as everything that I know, he's telling it absolutely accurately. And he didn't lie about himself.
Right.
He wasn't one of these people, like so many of them are, who one day he's saying this about himself, and the next day he tells it differently, and the next day, you know, or the next time it's something else again. He didn't do things like that.
He was an humble person. He was not an egotistical politician, and you know, he spoke honestly, and that's why, you know, I trust in the things that I read that he said, and the things he's written, as a man of the people, who spoke honestly.
Right. Well, okay, we got to as far as I thought we could possibly get to.
Right.
And so, you know, your reading was just excellent, as it always is.
Thank you.
And we'll just stop right here, and if there's anything more or any last words you've got.
Well, I appreciate everyone who is listening to us, and I hope you'll come back next week, because I know every week it gets more fascinating.
All right. You're right. So good night, everyone.
Good night.